Okay, good morning. Good to see you all. It's great to be here in Chicago. I'm a very big fan of this city and of your synagogue and your rabbi. And good to see you. We'll just learn for a little while this morning. I wanted to share just an interesting topic that I think is very relevant right now with everything happening in the world. It's kind of like a very important principle that's not well known that I wanted to share with you that we sort of realized during COVID could be extremely relevant and is not maybe utilized enough. And then I started to realize now also, just whenever there's trouble and difficulty in the world, it can be a very relevant principle. And I'll share with you what made me realize that with what's happening now, how central it could be. Two weeks ago now, I went on a rabbinic solidarity mission to Israel. And one of the things that we did there was we visited the Shura base. The Shura base is a rabbinic army base. What do they need rabbis for in the army? There's a lot of things that they do, but there's huge warehouses full of like tzitzis, all the tzitzis that are going out, and tehillim, and sidurim, and chumashim. We actually saw a stack when we were there, a stacks of 20,000 Art Scroll Gemaras arrived. Art Scroll had donated them of the soft cover Daf Yomi Gemaras. And they told us that they already told Art Scroll we need more because they already have requests for them all to go out. They're coming in and going out. So they're providing all the materials, the religious supplies. That's an exciting aspect of what's happening there. But also, right when I walked in, you know, so I work in a hospital. And during COVID, what made me realize personally like how bad it was when our morgue overflowed and we had two trucks full of corpses outside because we didn't have enough room in the morgue. And that's when I realized, like, this is serious. Right when I walked into this base, I saw 10 of those same trucks. And I asked, I knew what it was right away. And at one point I asked, and I said, yes, these are the bodies still waiting to be identified that we just are, that was their job there. They're basically a Chevra Kedisha. They're trying to identify the bodies. And this is part of their role. So one of the rabbis I was talking to there said, as a rabbi in the IDF, in Milu, my job is once a year I get called up. Once a year, Erev Pesach, to kosher the kitchen of the base. That's my job. Koshering a kitchen. Now my job is identifying dead bodies and horribly massacred, mutilated bodies. He said the army realized how difficult our job is in dealing with these corpses that they actually hired psychologists at the end of every shift to meet with us before we go home to decompress a little bit, to share what we're going through. He said, my first psychologist, the army hired a psychologist. We sat and talked. They gave me an hour. After 10 minutes, the psychologist broke down crying. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't. You have to find someone else. And he walked out. He said, even the psychologist that the army hired couldn't handle the things that we were saying to them. And it made me realize the level of suffering that is happening. I mean, this is just one example. He said to us, when you pray for the soldiers, when you pray for the sick, you know, we say, refuat ha-nefesh, refuat ha-guf, healing of body and healing of soul. He said, when you pray, refuat ha-nefesh, please have us in mind because we're scarred by what we're experiencing. And so my question is, and what I want to just deal with for a few minutes this morning is, does Jewish law recognize the need for limits sometimes? Can we ever limit how far is expected to go of us when caring for others? Can we, there was, for example, I'll just give you an example in the world of medicine. There was a following interesting question asked to a rabbi. I'm curious to hear what you would say. The rabbi was the stipler, Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky. This rabbi in Bnei Brak, he was asked by this man who was both a rabbi and a doctor. And he had a job offer in a place where there was a very small Jewish community. They needed a rabbi, but they had no schools, things like that. Or he could stay in the large Jewish community and be a doctor. So he asked this rabbi, what should I do? Should I be a doctor or a rabbi? And any guess? The rabbi in the small community, doctor in the big community. What should he do? Okay, right. You feel like he would go to the small. Maybe he's needed more there, but you're 100% right. What were you going to say?
No, I mean, say being a Dutch community is much easier than being a rabbi in a small community.
Right, much easier religiously. Yeah. Right.
But if he has a family, then he needs it
for trust. Right, he needs it for his family. So the answer he gave was fascinating because he said, Jewish law expects so much of a doctor that if you weigh where you're more likely to be able to live a proper Jewish life, you should go to the small town and be a rabbi. Because rabbi, okay, well, you know, what mistakes are you hopefully you'll do your best and lead the people properly. But a doctor, he said, it's not even so clear that a doctor is allowed to take a break. Because the doctor is expecting, if someone needs you and you're able to help them, how can you justify even taking a break? Because the expectations are so high. So this is my question. But can it possibly be that someone cannot take a break? Can they not go to sleep? Like, how could that be? So how do we articulate the role of self-care and of limits and of actually where we can draw lines for our own mental health and our own well-being? And there is a principle that I sort of realized how important it was during COVID, and I'll explain why. And I'm realizing, again, it's relevant in our world today, and I'll give some examples why, and I would love to hear your thoughts. And it's relevant in a lot of areas, and I'll give you some examples. And it's just a not very well-known concept, and that's part of why I wanted to share it with you, because I think it's fascinating and very relevant and important. So we'll just look at a couple sources, and then we'll discuss, and I'll hear your thoughts and just share with you a couple other examples of how it could be relevant. There was one theory, by the way. There was one theory when I was searching for this, you know, working in a hospital and trying to figure out what could be the way we could articulate these limits. And one theory we had was, what about returning lost objects? The basis of the obligation of many, even rabbis, and doctors and many people, for rabbis, they say their job is to return people's souls. For doctors, to return their health. Oftentimes, we articulate our responsibilities in terms of returning lost objects to people. But you don't have to return everything always. If you walk out of this shul this morning and you find a nickel on the ground, are you required to take an ad out in the Chicago Tribune? I found a nickel on Melrose. Like, is some, you know, someone please identify? Like, we're not. There's limits to how much you're expected to go. What? Yeah, exactly. There's lots of articulations. So some are. I wanted to say maybe that could be the limit. Like, you don't have to return everything. But then I realized some things go beyond the expectations of returning lost objects. There are things that are expected of you even beyond returning lost objects. So I wanted to come up with a better theory. So here we go. Here it is. We have the first source on the sheet there from the Talmud in Ketubot. Ketubos, Daf Nun Amud Aleph 50a. It says as follows. Amar Rabbi Ilai, Be'usha. In a city called Usha, Hiskinu, they made this following rule. Hamevazvez Al Yevazvez Yoter Michomesh. When one is spending money, particularly when one is giving tzedakah. When giving tzedakah, we know there's a concept of giving miser, of giving a tenth of one's earnings. So you should give a tenth, ideally, if you can. But you should not give more than a fifth, than 20%. There's a limit to how much you're allowed to give. Tanyana Mihachi, we learned also, Hamevazvez Al Yevazvez Yoter Michomesh, Shema Yitzarech Lebrios. Because maybe you too, if you're giving charity and helping people in need, but then you give away everything you have, next thing we know, you're the one who's in need, and it's just a vicious cycle. So we have to be careful that don't give away everything we have. That's the Talmudic principle. But how far can we take that principle? It's just saying, don't spend all your money, because you'll become poor yourself. You know, be generous, give to others, but don't give away too much, because you have to have certain limits there. So The code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, says here, in the second source in the sheet, and this becomes a really important principle, which we're gonna analyze a little bit. It says, now going to Sukkot, Sukkot, Esrog, purchasing an Esrog for Sukkot. Imkana Esrog Sheroi Letzeis Bo Betzimtzum. What if you bought an Esrog, and it fulfills the mitzvah. It's not a great Esrog, but it's good enough. It's like the size of an egg. It's small. V'achar kach matza gadol mimenu. But then afterwards, you already bought it. And I don't know about here in Chicago, but in most places, I think once you buy your esrog at the sukkah shop, it's a no return policy, right? You bought it, you buy it, you keep it. So you can't go back and ask for a return, right? So you now already spent the money. You bought an esrog, but now you see a better one. Do you have to now go and spend money again to buy a new one? So what it says is, mitzvah lehosif ad shlish milagav bidamei harishon. You should spend at least up to a third of the first one on the new one. If it's that cheap, that it's just a third of what the first one was more, then maybe spend the money to buy a new one. If it's much more expensive, you bought the first one for $20, this one's $100, you don't have to go out of your way to buy the new one. That's so far, okay? Kedei lachlifo b'yosir, now you have to buy the nicer one. Let's say you found two and you're choosing. One's nicer than the other. Again, you should buy the better one if it's not more than a third more expensive than the previous one. That's how far you're expected to go, at least to spend a little bit more. Okay, that's background. Now, in the italicized part, this is the Ramah. The Rav Moshe Isserle's glosses on the Code of Jewish Law says as follows. Umisha ain lo esrog, but if you don't have an esrog, or shar mitzvah averis, or any other mitzvah that's time is passing, you just don't have one. Ein tzarich levazis aleha hon rav. And then someone comes to town and says, oh, we have one esrog available in the whole city, and it's $5,000. Because, you know, it's economics. There was a movie about this, right? Ushpizin. Remember that movie, Ushpizin? The guy did spend all his money on it. His wife wasn't too happy with him. Well, according to this, he did the wrong thing. You know, you don't spend an absorbent, especially if it's a fifth of your possession, you do not need to spend it. You just won't do esrog that year. And that happened in Europe in particular many times. You know, they didn't have them always readily available. They were often poor and they didn't grow naturally in many of those communities. And there would be times when either no one had one or just the rabbi had one. And that's the halacha. And it quotes now our Gemara. It says, "Kamosh amru hamavazves al yavazves yosher michomesh." When you spend on charity, you don't have to spend more than a fifth. That also applies to a mitzvah, filu mitzvah veris, except v'davka mitzvah saseh. That's only when it's coming to do a mitzvah. Aval lo taseh, but when there's a prohibition, yitain komemono kodem shiavor. You should ideally spend everything in order to not transgress a mitzvah. That's a different issue. So now we see that we have a concept of not spending more than a fifth of your possessions to give tzedakah. Now we see it's also not spending more than a fifth to do a mitzvah. But now I want to ask, how far can we extend this principle and give some examples? By the way, I just put on this short sheet as a side point, the Aruch HaShulchan there, also in Simen Resh Mem Tes Sif Hey, that just mentions as a side point that I thought was just relevant. And the bottom line there, it says, V'nir li devilat pidyon shvuyim Rashai l'hosif ala chomesh. When it comes to redeeming captives, you could spend more than a fifth. There might be less limits when it comes to redeeming captives. We might need to spend even more to be able to get captives back. That's just a relevant side point. But let's look at how far we can expand this principle. Now let me give you three examples that I think take this principle to whole new realms. And our potential with this is really fascinating. First is Reb Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein, great renowned rabbinic thinker in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, he was asked the following question by someone who was in a mental health institution. He had been hospitalized because of his mental illness. And I'll read it. It's a short little piece here. It says, Nishalti be'echa chaya chole b'machle shtus. Person suffering from mental illness, who be'beis cholim. And he's in a mental health hospital where he needs to be there. Venirpa, and he is now doing much better. He is even, he uses the word cured there. Aval, harofim omrim shetzarech lios sham od eze shavuos tachas hashka chasam kidei shalo yizkalka chas v'shalom. But his course of treatment is, let's say it's a 3 month that they need, the doctors say you must be there for 3 months. He has now been there for 2 months. He's doing better. But the doctors say, you know, we are aware of this condition that you have and it needs 3 months. It's almost like antibiotics. You know, oftentimes they'll give you antibiotics and they'll say, take this for 10 days. And after 2 or 3 days, you're like, oh, I feel better, I'm fine. But the doctors say, it has to be 10 days. You stop now, it's going to come back. So that's often true with mental health as well. They'll say, you need to be here. This is a 3 month treatment. You have to work the system. But you say you're better. It's only been 2 months, but we need you here another month. But here's the problem. This man is a religious Jew, and he says, I've been here 2 months. I'm doing better now, and Rosh Hashanah is next week. And they don't allow a shofar into this facility. For whatever reason, that's the case, right? He says it here, just to conclude, that his writing says, Im tzrichim lo tziu misham kadei shiyakayim mitzvah shofar. Should he leave? He'll have to go AMA. Should he leave this facility To hear the shofar, shebebeis acholim e efsha. They will not let him hear it in this hospital for whatever reason. So what do you say? I mean, on the one hand, he needs to be there for his mental health. On the other hand, he's doing better. And it's the mitzvah shofar. You have one chance to hear the shofar. It's such an important mitzvah. What should he do? Pekuach nefesh. Because how mental health can be a life-threatening... Yes. So that's
if you're in a hospital, if you're in a mental hospital,
exactly.
Chances are...
Exactly. This is a serious issue that he needs to really treat. Okay? Pekuach nefesh. Excellent.
I can't just go and come back.
For whatever reason, right, that could be an easy answer, but for whatever reason, their rule is, you're in the program, if you leave, you're out. I don't know why, but let's just assume that that's the reality, because it seems like from the question that for some reason he has to choose. I'm either here or I'm there, and I can't do both. So yes, pekuach nefesh would be an excellent answer, but he gives a different answer, which enables us to broaden the discussion even more. And he says as follows. He says, Vashafti, I responded, that in my opinion, Ein trichim lotziu. He does not have to leave. In other words, stay in the hospital there. Ki al ase gam ones mamon yosher michomesh nechshav ones. When it comes to spending money, having to pay more than a fifth is considered ones, meaning it's out of your control. You don't have to do it anymore. Lefotra, to make you exempt. Vulai gam bepachos michomesh, and that might even apply to less than a fifth, actually. He quotes some sources there that prove that. Vim kein kol shekein zeh. Now going to the last line. So certainly in this case, it's worth a person, their mental well-being, their mental health is worth them more than a fifth. They would certainly spend more than a fifth of their possessions to have their mental health taken care of. Probably everything. This is more important than the mitzvah of shofar, and therefore to leave the hospital would be like spending more than a fifth of one's possessions, because it's spending more, giving it more than a fifth of their self to have to hear the shofar. It's important to hear the shofar, but their own well-being is more valuable, and therefore he said, stay in the hospital, don't hear the shofar, that's what's more important. And this principle, so now Rav Moshe Feinstein has done something fascinating. He's not the first one to do it. He has taken this principle outside of the realm of tzedakah. That was one thing, okay? I think that made sense. When you're writing a check for tzedakah, don't give more than a fifth of your entire, savings. Then we said, well, it also applies to a mitzvah. You don't have to do a mitzvah if it's going to be so expensive. Now we're saying it's not just about money. We're analogizing our money to our emotional well-being. And we're saying that we have to care for ourselves, and we can actually say certain things I can't be expected to give that much of myself, of my own well-being, of my mental health, and I can say I can't do it. I'll give you a couple really powerful examples. Here's a COVID example. Rav Hershel Schachter was asked the following question. It's similar to this Shura Army base that I mentioned. During COVID, especially in the first parts of it, the Chevra Kadishas were nervous. Do they have to do a tahara, a ritual washing of the bodies of people who had died from COVID, especially in those first weeks, first months, when it was especially, scary and serious, as it was for many months? Do they still have to wash the bodies? And Rabbi Hershel Schechter wrote a response where he argued that to expect them to wash the bodies in that circumstance would be giving more than a fifth of themselves, and therefore they're not required. I actually, during COVID, I had this following experience. So I'm a chaplain in a hospital. We didn't know, they said essential workers stay in the hospital, and non-essential, go home. We don't want you in the hospitals. We don't want it crowded. We want social distancing, etc. So us chaplains, no one told us because, it was a little bit chaos. And no one said you're essential, you're not essential. And us chaplains, we were like, well, we think we're essential, but do they think we're essential? We don't know. We just have to decide, and are we essential or not? And we were like, I don't know. Then the second day after the lockdown in the hospital, I got a call from a nurse. A patient had died, and the family wanted a rabbi to come say prayers and to guide the nurses and all the customs. So she called me up to the COVID ICU. So I went up there, and at that time we actually had an armed security guard outside of the door, not letting anyone in unless they had permission. I thought I had been called there. So I walk in, he says, whoa, you're not on my list, you're not essential. I was like, okay, I guess it's been decided. I guess we're not allowed in. I said, okay, I'm sorry. I was called up, but if I'm not allowed, I won't go. As I turned around, there were glass doors. The nurse who had called me sees me leaving. She opens the door. She says, Rabbi, where are you going? We just called for you. And I looked at the security guard, and he says, oh, okay, go ahead. I was like, okay, I guess it's been decided. That's it. I guess we're essential. And then from that day on, we decided we're essential. We're going in. The next day, a family of a patient called me who was a Holocaust survivor. The patient's a Holocaust survivor. And the nurse, the protocol at that time was she would only go in twice a day into the room. She would sit outside the room. She was there for him, but she would try to do everything at once to not overly expose herself. But the family was worried because whenever they talked to the patient, he expressed how thirsty he was. And as a survivor, that was especially triggering, to be so thirsty and alone in the hospital. And the nurse had said, you know, the family said, if the chaplain goes in and talks to him, brings him water, will you allow that? She said, yeah, the chaplain goes in, that's fine. So I walked in. This is like the second, third day of the whole lockdown. And I put on all the gear. I gave him the water. And he was so thirsty that he started like chugging it down ravenously so fast that he started choking and he coughed all over me. And even though I was wearing all the gear, I felt it like going dripping down my shirt. And I was like, oh, I'm like dripping with COVID water. I'm going to die. I was like, what am I going to tell my wife? My first thought was, did I make a mistake? Maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Thank God I survived. I didn't even get COVID from that, as far as I know. I just went through the backyard, took my clothes off, went straight to the shower, put my clothes in the laundry. But I was thinking like, should I be going this far? I don't know. Maybe I'm risking myself too much. And this was like a constant debate. So that's another example. Another example in halacha, fascinating example, an important example. There was a case of an Orthodox man who was gay. And he went to his rabbi and he said, Rabbi, what is expected of me? You know, I'm a gay man and I'm in the Orthodox community. Am I expected to marry a woman? And his rabbi said, you are. And I don't think we even asked if he's expected, but this rabbi told him, yeah, you must marry a woman despite being gay. And he thought, I can't believe that he told me that. So he went to another rabbi, Rabbi Chaim Rappaport in England, who is known as a massive scholar. And he said to him, I can't believe what this rabbi told me. I'm expected to marry a woman, even though I'm a gay man. I want to stay in the Orthodox community. I want to live an Orthodox life, but is that really expected of me? And Rabbi Rappaport said, definitely not. You're not expected. So then he went and told the previous rabbi. And he said, how could he say that? What's his source? So Rabbi Rappaport wrote a response, and actually wrote a whole book on it. And it all came down to this principle. He said, to expect you to marry a woman as a gay man, to expect you to marry a woman, that's giving more than a fifth of your own mental well health, of your own well-being. How can we expect that of you? That's so contradicting your identity, your yourself, who you are. And so, no, you're not expected of that. That's giving more, because this applies not just to money, but also to your mental health, your emotional well-being. And so you're not required. He wrote a whole book to make his argument as strong as possible, which many people found extremely compelling. It was just a fascinating, another example of how far this principle can be relevant in so many areas of life. I'll show you one more, and then we'll start to get specific and wrap up, and I want to hear your reactions. But if you turn the page, the second side of the page, this is a new book that came out by Rabbi Rav David Cohen. Rav David Cohen, the Gvul Yavetz, is a big posek in Brooklyn, a Haredi posek, very prolific author. And he gave a series of classes on mental health and halacha. It's called Psychology and Halacha. It's actually a Hebrew title. It's called Harofe L'Shurei Lev. And I was reading it, and I was shocked by what I read, because he deals with an issue that's a very common issue, but I had not seen any rabbis deal with this issue. And that's the issue of adults who become estranged from their parents. And can that ever be justified? And I'm not encouraging it. You know, I have 5 children myself. I hope they never do this to me. It's not something that we want to have happen. It's not a great thing, but it's also a reality in life that sometimes there are strained relationships, and that's a reality. And can a child ever justify disengaging from the relationship with their parents when there is a mitzvah of kibud av va'em, a mitzvah of honor your parents, and it's one of the 10 commandments? So would you tell a child who feels that their relationship with their parents is emotionally damaging them, that they nevertheless have to maintain the relationship, or do they have the right or obligation in Jewish law to pull back from that relationship? And look at what he writes. I was so surprised when I read this and fascinated. And well, let's read it together. So he says as follows. In therapy, clients often grapple with shailas involving kibud av v'aim, questions about honoring their parents. If the counselor ascertains that a parent is acting in a way that is damaging to the child's emotional health, as is often the case where parents are abusive or overly controlling, he may counsel the child to disregard the parent's requests or even to disengage entirely from the parent in order to heal. This also applies in situations where the parents are not abusive, but the troubled parent-child relationship is adversely affecting the child's emotional health and long-term stability. What's his source for this? How could he say such a thing? So if you look in the Hebrew footnote, right in the middle of the page there, footnote 31, second paragraph, he says, V'od tam, here's my reason. Mehad isa ben Ramah, as the Ramah says, Mi she'ein lo esrog, oshar mitzvah veris, if you don't have an esrog or other passing mitzvah, ein tzarech levazvez aleh hon rav, you don't have to spend a lot of money on it, k'mo she'amru ha'mevazvez al yevazvez yoser michomesh, as we learned. So he now is applying this principle, as Rav Moshe started the precedent, to mental well-being and saying that a person could even disengage from their relationship with their parents and not fulfill the commandment, one of the Ten Commandments, right there, because of the damage it's doing to their mental health and their emotional well-being, which is a fascinating application of this principle and shows how far one could take this this idea. Yes?
I'm curious. Why there is no reference to pikuach in that way, which could conceivably be extended to cover such emotional
right.
And
right, and that came up before. And you're right. On the one hand, there's, first of all, pikuach nefesh, the word itself, literally, because there are many who say it's not just pikuach nefesh of saving a life, but it's also pikuach ha-nefesh, or pikuach nefesh shel nefesh, saving emotional, saving your life in that way. And also, in addition to the fact that pikuach nefesh relates to someone could become suicidal or hurt themselves, and so it's also relevant. So it is an important principle, and I'm not disregarding that principle, but I think the rabbis feel, first of all, sometimes it's not necessarily pikuach nefesh, meaning you can only take that principle so far. I mean, what if it's not really, you could deal with it, you could overcome it, but
it's not
life and death. So sometimes the rabbis get nervous because sometimes they feel we take that principle too far. And because that allows everything, right? Once you say pikuach nefesh, and sometimes the rabbis get nervous, like, it's too much. And I don't want to let it go in every case. And sometimes there's a need for like a more specific. In fact, I'll give you some examples. In COVID, so when we were trying to figure out, like, how do we help people? Once we realized, you know, COVID at first we thought it was going to be 2 weeks. And then we realized it's not, it was much longer. Just like this war, I mean, you know, it was one horrible day and then it's a long thing. So we realized, how can we use this principle? So here was my suggestion. Here's what we did at my hospital. I said, if someone normally works 50 hours a week, let's say that's their normal work week, we need to make a rule. They may not work more than 60 hours a week. That would be adding more than a fifth. There needs to be a limit. Of course, there could be, you can imagine, sometime there's 1 week when something came up and just was unexpected and they had to work more, but you have to have a limit. Or they normally take off 14 days a year. So we'd say, we have to have a limit. You cannot take off less than 11 days. You can't cut more than a fifth. So, but that wouldn't have been a pikuach nefesh necessarily to say, like, but you can say, like, this principle gives us a way to articulate another avenue for self-care and emotional well-being that we can actually quantify and use in a broad array of cases that could be very helpful. So pikuach nefesh is one principle, but this is just, it gives us another tool, I think, to deal with struggles. Yes. Well said. Yeah, it's a nuance within, right? It doesn't, you don't have to say rise to the pikuach nefesh on off switch, but this is a dimmer. I like that. That's a very nice way to say it.
So regarding the one fifth, how do we quantify that? How do we know when it comes to mental well-being?
Good.
And also, right, with the example you gave regarding, well, I don't know, something clicked in my mind.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, no, the cue it up.
Yeah.
Right. It takes more than one fifth of your mental well-being. Preparing for Shabbos can be very stressful. More than right?
Right.
Are we going with that? So,
right.
Say, oh, you don't have to do Shabbos anymore because it's
right. And this, and you, what you're hinting at is might be one of the reasons why this principle is not necessarily quoted so commonly, because I once gave this presentation. I don't want to embarrass anyone, but I remember once just saying, just curious, had anyone ever heard of this before? And no one, it was a large room, no one had even heard of it. So maybe this was one of the reasons why the rabbis are nervous about spreading this idea too broadly, because it's like, right, how far do you want to take it? But the idea of how to quantify it is, the issue is really, this is all about, comes down to Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho. Only you know how much you're suffering. And sometimes to have an idea in yourself of like, okay, I can't tell you, oh, what you're doing here, that's, you know, that's, you're giving 17.5%. But if you do this, it's 21.2%. How, it's so hard to quantify so issues in our lives. But if you can try to know yourself, like sometimes, like I had a friend who used to teach me about like, mindfulness, and you should talk about like knowing, like so for example, when you feel stress, trying to identify which part of your body, where are you feeling the stress? Is it in your neck? Is it in your shoulders? Sometimes it can help you to kind of like help yourself when you kind of articulate what you're feeling. And if you can sort of try to help yourself know, like, is, how much am I giving of myself here? Is this crossing the line? Because on the one hand, 1/5 is a lot, 20%. But on the other hand, it's not that much. Like it's not saying you have to go 99%. It's kind of not the highest bar. But I mean, I tried to use this with some people with news consumption right now. Like let's see how many hours are you looking at the news and how many do you normally look at, and can we make sure it's not going more than 1/5 more? Like, because I had a patient in the hospital who his nurse asked me, they called down to my office and said, can you come with this patient is freaking out. Those are his words. And I had seen this patient a few times already, and I walked in the room and he was bleeding on his fist because he had punched the side of his bed because of something he saw in the news about what's happening in Israel. He was so angry. And I noticed that every time I'd been in his room, he's watching the news. And I said, let me ask you a question. How often do you have this news on? He said, oh, Rabbi, always. I even sleep with it on. I was like, I have an idea. What if I take out of the, you know, the in the hospital they have those little remote controls that plug into the wall. I said, what if I take this out of the wall, I turn it off, and I'll just give you a daily update, and you don't watch the news anymore. He was like, I don't know if I can handle it. I was like, I promise. I'll give you an update of all you need to know. And his nurse was in the room, like nodding his head, like, yeah. And I was like, and I was like, you need to stop watching the news. And to me, I was like, that's this principle of like, it's too far. Maybe sometimes he didn't see it himself, but sometimes we can see it ourselves. But it is a challenge to quantify. But on the other hand, it's sometimes helpful to quantify because it's like, it gives us numbers, to help, way to articulate these things. Sometimes it's beneficial. Yes.
And I'm wondering like how you discern when it's appropriate to do that, because I'm thinking about like, what if the nurse in the COVID ward had turned to you and said, should I quit my job and risk my life every day?
Right.
What would you have said? What if the rabbis who are damaging themselves every day by doing this work had turned to you and said, should I quit my job? What would you say?
Yeah.
Right? So when you're asked to do something that absolutely needs to be done, but will inevitably take more than a
right.
How do you discern whether or not it's the right thing to do?
It's a very hard question. It's a very good question. Yeah, how do you discern when it's the right thing? Because a lot of times you know that you're being asked to do something that's needed, it's important, but it will take more than 1/5 of you, but it's needed. The world needs it. I mean, it's a huge challenge because there are roles in the world that are expected. The example from the Torah is, it says that judges should not fear anyone. So the rabbis asked, what judges in court of law? He says, well, because judges, it could risk their lives also. You know, they persecute someone, they convict someone, they could come back and get revenge. So, but the rabbis say, but the world, so what about pikuach nefesh? Because you would say, how could you, anyone be a judge? If there could be theoretically a time when if you call, convict someone of being guilty or of being innocent and their family is upset or whatever it is, it could be pikuach nefesh. But the society needs judges. It needs a system of law and order. So it's essential. So certain people are expected to go above and beyond. But within that, people have to be able to ask themselves, but at what point, first of all, can I set limits on how far I'm going, whether it's the amount of hours I'm doing or how many years I'm doing this for? Or can I just recognize when I can do this for some time, at which point I've passed my limits? Or for some people, you know, the world needs people doing these roles, whether it's doctors, nurses, but it's not for me. Like, I realize that not everyone, you know, people are different, and there's lots of ways people can contribute, but sometimes you might realize, and you have to be able to pull back. So it's a big challenge. Even though I said before, Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, and only you know your own suffering, and that's a very true principle, we also have another principle of Ein Chovesh Matir Atzmo Mibeit HaAsurim. A prisoner cannot free themselves from prison. You need sometimes someone else. We apply that to mental health as well. Sometimes you can't do it all yourself. You need someone else from the outside to say, you know what, I'm talking to you, I know you, I'm realizing you're going too far now. You need a break. You need to pull back. Yeah.
Also look at, I don't know if it's the halakha around fasting, but when you look at the fact that if someone doesn't think they should fast, or someone thinks that they are able to fast, and the doctor says they should not, uh-huh. then you follow the doctor.
Uh-huh.
If someone thinks they are not able to fast, and the doctor says that they are, you trust yourself.
Yes.
And say, I do not fast.
Yes, very good. That's the principle of tzarich ani, I need it. And we trust that. And yes, and that actually, that's a whole other talk for a whole other time. But I'll just say very, very briefly that I was once asked by a pain specialist if he could, he was a very specific pain specialist. And he asked me, he was in a city where there was no others who did his specific role. And there were some of his patients who really, really suffer. And he treats them. And he asked me if he could violate Shabbos. Like many doctors can drive on Shabbos if they need to save a life. But his patients are chronic pain patients. They're not dying. It's not pikuach nefesh. They're just in a lot of pain. And he can save them from their pain. He asked me, can I violate Shabbos for that need? And he says, my patients say they need me. And I asked one rabbi, and the rabbi said no. I asked Rav Asher Weiss, who's the head of postdoc for Shaar Tzedek Medical Center, a big rabbi in Israel, and he gave me that answer. He said, the principle of my need, tzarech ani, can actually override Shabbos in many cases, and if that patient really needs their doctor, and he's the only one who can do it, or she is the only one who can do it, and they need to drive on Shabbos, they could justify it based on that principle. So there's a lot of these principles, because I don't know if they could justify it in the 1/5 principle, or even pekuach nefesh necessarily, because it's not pekuach nefesh, but it is tzarech ani. So yes, very good. A couple more, we'll wrap up. Thank you. Yeah. Right.
So how would this, I guess that doesn't raise an issue for keeping up an aim or not spending a huge amount of your time making meals for sick people, but how would that,
yeah, it's fascinating. There are times, right, for pekuach nefesh to save a life, you can go above a fifth. In fact, in halacha, if a person is extremely wealthy, even though we said you can't give more than a 20th, because you'll become poor, but if a person has $10 billion, I mean, obviously, even less than that, but so, okay, I'm left with $8 billion, like, I'm going to be okay, right? And then obviously that could be with a much lower number. So then the rabbi said, yeah, you could give away more than a fifth if you're fabulously rich. But also there are limits in terms of what one person is expected to do. Sometimes we say in halacha that there's communal expectations, but not individual. A person can't be expected at all times to provide for every single need because it's ein ledavar sof. It's there's no end to it. So yes, even though we would be expected to give a little more of ourselves when it comes to saving a life, that still has a limit. It's not clear. Even when it says pidyon shvuyim, to free captives, it's not necessarily meaning that one individual is expected to give all of their possessions, but it might mean the community is expected to pull together. So there's communal expectations sometimes for pekuach nefesh. So that's a good question. Good point. Is there a last comment? Yes, please. Yeah.
Because then the Gemara is like, can't, but then later we send, is it when we extend the analogy that it's just, we don't have to, or is that, are there no distinction, or is it always in the language of Esor about going above the
So you're saying, when is it obligated and when is it prohibited?
Yeah, where is it where you just don't have to go over the 1/5 versus?
It seems like in general the language is that it's prohibited because it's mevazves al yevazves. You know, it's actually prohibited to go more than a fifth. That's my impression. I mean, that's why because when you say to the person like, I want to hear the shofar. So is it, you know, we use the language on the one hand of onus, but it's because you're prohibited. Your obligation is to, you know, care for your mental health. So, I mean, it's a great example. I'll conclude with one final example, one interesting one, but it's taking it out of this realm, but just because you reminded me of this, and so we'll wrap up. There's a fascinating question that I deal with a lot that I'm sure many people have of, you know, it's actually a marriage question, but it's related. The following question happened. There was a couple that got married, and they did genetic screening before they got married, as is appropriate. But they did it with blind screening, like Dor Yesharim, where they don't find out the results. All they knew was they're a match. They're genetically compatible. Then the sister of the bride does her own testing for something, and she finds out she's a carrier for something. And her doctor tells her, which is appropriate, the doctor says, you should inform your family members that you should all know that you're a carrier for this genetic mutation. So she tells her mom. Her mom says, oh, I better tell your sister. She pulls her sister aside, the one who's married now, and says, I want you to know that we and our family found out that we're carriers for something. Obviously, it's not an issue for you because your husband's not, and therefore it should be fine, but I wanted to tell you, but do not tell your husband because your sister said we want to keep it confidential, and she's afraid people will know about it, whatever, because of stigma. And so I'm telling you now, but don't tell your husband. Then her mother leaves. Then her husband says, what was that so important that your mom wanted to tell you? What does she say now? She can either lie to her husband and say, oh, it was nothing, as her mother basically asked her to, or she can violate honoring her parents and say, I'll tell you the truth, even though my mom told me to lie to you. What should she do? What? Okay, there could be ways.
Go to the doctor who did the testing and find out, is he a carrier for this particular thing?
Okay.
Keep it up and doesn't extend to sewing. So if you're asked to do something, then in the first place, lying to someone, then you would have a problem.
Right, very good. So they asked the rabbi, and the rabbi said, actually, shalom bayis, peace in the home, comes before honoring one's parents. And I always tell this about like the couples when they're choosing a name for a baby, because oftentimes they get pressure from their parents. I tell them, it's your choice, you know, you make the decision. You people have to make their own decisions. They shouldn't, you know, a common cause of divorce, unfortunately, is in-laws. But this is just another example of some of these issues that we struggle with and how, you know, halacha has avenues for us to deal with them. I think the one-fifth principle is it doesn't answer every question and it can't be applied in every situation, but I think it's just a great articulation of how we can navigate some of these challenging issues, and especially in challenging times like we're in right now, just having more, as many tools in our toolkit, so to speak, to be able, especially halachically, to be able to navigate and live an authentic, religiously observant life while also being able to maintain our mental health, our mental well-being, is crucially important.